This episode of the Glass Half Empty podcast is brought to you by Kingsford. From trade rumors to free agent signings to managerial changes, hot stove talk is about to heat up. Let's keep those flames growing strong because there's no off season when it comes to grilling.
Rodgers in trouble. It's going to get there. He turned 32 yesterday. Does he have a vintage moment in it? In the end zone, it is caught for the win. Richard Rodgers with a walk-off touchdown. A game ender for the Packers.
Welcome to the Glass Half Empty podcast on the Big Lead. I'm Ryan Glasspiegel. Our guest today doesn't really need an introduction. He's been at ESPN covering baseball for a very long time. He appears on their Sunday Night Baseball telecast. He's actually the longest tenured member of that broadcast. He's going into his ninth season on it. Welcome, Buster Olney. Buster, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great, Ryan. Hang in there. I know you're playing hurt, so am I.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you right off the bat, you wrote a piece this week saying that it's not necessarily that Chris Bryant is going to be traded from the Cubs, but he could be had for the right price. Can you explain how you came about this information and what your general idea of it is?
Yeah, just in talking with sources in baseball, what I learned was that the Cubs had indicated to other teams, look, and this was, you know, Chris Bryant was among many players talked about in these discussions. If you're interested in making an offer on Chris Bryant, we're all ears. And, you know, this is in those conversations between teams, there's a lot of nuance. There's sometimes when they have conversations, they'll basically indicate, look, this player we might talk about him, but probably not. Or this player, we're almost certainly not going to talk about. And what I learned was from folks in baseball is that their sense was that the Cubs had sort of moved to a different place with Chris, who, of course, is a Scott Boras client, who hasn't been able to reach a long-term agreement with the team. And it doesn't mean that they would necessarily trade him. It doesn't even necessarily mean that they're really interested in trading him. But the fact that they're basically indicating teams were ready to hear offers puts them in a different place than where they've been in the past.
Yeah, and he would be very valuable. I mean, I know he had two DL stints this past year, and his stats weren't quite as good as they've been before, but he is still very young. He is still under arbitration control for 3 years. He could get some pretty high-level prospects in return, conceivably, right?
Yeah, and the Cubs right now, I think at a point, you know, after I think having, in their eyes, disappointing results in 2017-2018, it seems like, just from talking with folks within baseball, that they are in a place where there's a broader evaluation going on. You know, they weren't wild last summer about their clubhouse culture. You know, you've seen them make repeated coaching changes the last couple of years. And their farm system's not in great shape because for years, of course, they, you know, promoted, graduated those guys into the big leagues. And so now as they moved ahead to 2019, they don't have a lot of different avenues, a broad range of avenues to get better with next year's team. And trading Chris Bryant would theoretically possibly be one of them, which is why I think they're at least open to the discussion.
You mentioned the clubhouse culture. Now, Chris Bryant's obviously not a bad guy or anything.
No.
There's been no stories about that. But Theo Epstein, he was very specific in using the word edge and saying that the Cubs had been lacking it. And so Bryant is like a consummate professional. He does his job. There's no drama with him. But now, like what initially when that story came out, I was thinking that it might be about Joe Maddon. But now that your story has come out, it got me wondering if they're a little bit concerned that Bryant isn't kind of a rah-rah leader.
No, I don't think so. I think that they're basically what they're looking for generally, and this is not necessarily, on a given team, I don't think it has to be tied to one particular player, but it can sometimes be tied to like an esprit de corps where that team shows up on a given day that just wants to rip your guts out, okay? And there, I think the most recent example that I saw was in the World Series, where you had the Red Sox on one hand. They were all in, like all their starting pitchers volunteering, going out to the bullpen, spikes on, we're going to do everything we can to win. And on the other hand, it certainly felt like the Dodgers that, you know, and this is not, I don't think, a fault of any individual player. It just had a different feel to it. And I, you know, talked to other media members who saw the same thing. And maybe, and I'm not around the Cubs every day the way that Jesse Rogers is, and he can answer this question better, but maybe that's what Theo's talking about. And it, look, when teams win championships, you know, part of the challenge that you hear from folks after the fact about, you know, repeating or winning another title is to sort of build the same hunger and to create the same hunger. And maybe just after 2016, the front office doesn't feel like the same hunger that is there that was in 2015, 2016.
So you also mentioned that there aren't a lot of other avenues for the team. Does that mean that you can't see them getting a huge name free agent, a la like Bryce Harper or Manny Machado?
I think that it's possible that they could, but you know, there are two problems with that. One, they would have to either blow past the luxury tax threshold, which they're bumping up against. And I, you know, talked with folks with other teams who do the evaluations of all 30 teams, you know, 29 opponents, and I heard that in mid October, like, you know, the Cubs are really kind of in a tough place with their payroll. So they could either blow through that to get one of those two players or you know, some other significant player, or they would have to offset it with a deal, which, again, brings us back to Brian. Given where he's at, I think it was MLB Trade Rumors had his number for the upcoming season through arbitration around $12 million. It'll obviously climb after that. That might be one of the reasons why you might consider trading him, would be to carve out some space. But I don't think that's the, you know, the necessarily the way that the Cubs would go about it, because their farm system is not in great shape, because they don't have a lot of space under the luxury tax threshold. They have to be very inventive to try to make the team better. And we saw, you know, what they did, for example, with the Cole Hamels situation, where they exercised his option, but also had to dump a contract in order to make that happen.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Staying in Chicago, I keep seeing rumors that, not even rumors, but quotes from White Sox brass that they're really willing to make a splash. Do you see that actually happening in free agency, or is this kind of get the base excited noise, but not all that significant?
There's no doubt that the White Sox are viewed as a tremendous wild card by the other teams in baseball this winter. Like, for example, I'm working on a piece on Yasmani Grandal and asking the question, okay, which team would be the team that would step out and sign a Grandal, given the fact he just turned down a qualifying offer? And so often the conversations you have with folks is, well, the White Sox have a ton of payroll flexibility. They clearly in the last few years have been trying to build towards you know, a time when they compete with the Indians for the American League Central title. And, you know, Jerry Reinsdorf is someone who's been in baseball a long time. You know, he craves championships. We saw that with, you know, with the Bulls, with the White Sox. And in the past, with other players, especially back in the 90s, he would surprise people in the industry by stepping out and making a big signing. I think the question is whether or not the White Sox could convince a Machado or a Harper to come there, given the fact that, let's face it, probably in 2019 it would be pretty ugly because they still have a long way to go in developing their young pitching.
Yeah, that's why it would make sense from my end. I guess there's better, more marquee free agents this year, but like it seems like they're a year away from signing somebody of that caliber just because – there's no reason to do it and still have the team be bad this year.
Yeah, and that's, I think that they sort of announced their intention. You remember during the winter meetings last year when the Orioles put Manny Machado's name out there in trade talks, and, you know, we heard about the Cardinals and we heard about the Yankees and, you know, the usual suspects. And the team, I think, that surprised everybody was the White Sox. And, you know, their working theory as they went through those conversations with the Orioles was, look, if we execute a trade for Machado. We bring him here for a year. We can convince him to, you know, maybe that he likes Chicago. He likes playing for us, and that'll give us a better chance to sign him to a deal. I think, you know, they probably, like other teams, have looked at the free agent markets and determined if we want to make a big strike, this is the best chance we have, you know, trying to lure a Machado or a Harper. I would say this, if that ever happens, it kind of reminds me of what happened with the Rangers and Alex Rodriguez when they gave him $252 million and blew away the rest of the market. They would have to overpay, I think, to get either one of those two guys.
That makes a lot of sense as well. This offseason, it's obviously more top-heavy and deeper free agent class than it was last year. But last year, the prices that free agents commanded really disappointed the agents, the union, and the players. Why will this offseason be different?
I don't think it is going to be different for most of the players. I think that, you know, there are going to be some starting pitchers like Patrick Corbin, like Nathan Eovaldi, maybe Dallas Keuchel. You know, you mentioned the two key position players who are going to be paid well. But the growing problem for the union, and I think this is reflected in the relief market, is just the exploding number of players. So last winter, when all, you know, there was great disappointment for the union that there wasn't a real market, so many veteran guys took one-year deals. All those guys are back. You know, they're back in the market. The number of relievers now in the free agent market has doubled within 3 years. And you have an issue of supply and demand. And so, for example, if there's a reliever who says, look, I want a three-year deal for $30 million, if you're an interested team, you might say, you know what, I'll take my shot on another guy 1 year and $5 million. That's what we've seen happen with the first base, third base, corner outfield market in recent years, and I fear that it's going to, fear for the union that it's going to happen to a group of pitchers as well. It's, I think in the end, we're going to again see in late January, early February, a lot of players left unsigned.
Yeah, to that end, it seems like after the initial flurry of big signings, there's a big kind of bargain hunting contingent. And
yep.
So John Heyman, a couple weeks ago, he listed the top 131 free agents. And it looks like there's a lot of value from like 26 to 32 on his list. He had J.A. Happ 26th. He had David Robertson 29th. Cole Hamels 30th. Andrew Miller, 31st, who could be a flyer if he's healthy. Daniel Murphy at 32. Those are all people who in 2019 could really conceivably contribute to a winning roster.
I would agree with that. I think Andrew Miller is going to do well. He's among the names you mentioned. He would be the one guy I'd say I think would be an exception because he's left-handed, because his fastball velocity was high, and there were a lot of indications that he was healthy down the stretch. I think he's going to do well like a lot of relievers did last year. But I think Daniel Murphy's the classic example of a guy who might get chewed up by the supply and demand issue. There's so many free agent second basemen. Ian Kinsler, DJ LeMahieu, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It feels like there are about eight guys and there are about three spots. Now, you know, Murphy is a better pure hitter, I think, than a lot of those guys. There's some positional flexibility, maybe play some first base. We saw in the second half when he was more healthy after having the knee surgery that he can have some impact. He certainly, I thought, played well for the Cubs. But in the cold of the winter, it is amazing how the supply and demand issue really works against the players.
Definitely. I wanted to pivot and start talking about your career a little bit. As I mentioned in the introduction, you're headed into your ninth season on Sunday Night Baseball. Did you notice an uptick in the buzz of the property this season with A-Rod on it?
Yeah, I mean, look, if Alex gets involved in anything, there's going to be more attention to it. And, you know, there would certainly, when he would say things, whether it's early in the year and talking about an evaluation of a player, where he had the situation with, you know, where he was very pointed in his comments about Darvish, absolutely it's going to get more attention. That's part of the reason why they wanted him on board and why the, you know, ESPN pursued him. So, yeah, I don't think there's any question about it.
You came up in this industry as a writer. Now you've been doing this broadcast for a while, but how difficult was it at first to go from having a long time to dispense your thoughts to then kind of quick hit studio segments, but then on the games, you really got to deliver information in 15 to 20 to 30 seconds. Yeah. How hard was that to learn that transition?
It's funny you say that, because when I was a writer, you know, I worked for newspapers for years and years, and I was very dismissive of folks in TV, because you thought, okay, really, you're gonna try to do it, as you say, in 15 to 20, 25 seconds. And then once I got into it, because I felt like at the time I left the New York Times that I had to have a different type of challenge, and it was important to sort of keep pushing yourself to do different things, and I had no training in it, but then you realize the challenge is exactly the same, and I thought you couched it perfectly. In writing a game story for the New York Times, you try to do the best you can to convey the best information in 800 words, and in television, it really is, you know, 25 to 30 seconds, or on Sunday Night Baseball, trying to omit the proper thought and the right information before the next pitch is delivered, before that pause happens, and try to do the best job of that. And I can tell you, I mean, I love during the wintertime when I go back and, you know, speak to journalism students, they have an annual seminar down at Vanderbilt, and go to different places during the winter. I always tell the horror stories. The first time I was doing television, which, if you don't mind, I can tell my favorite one. It was in the fall of 2003, and I had just started at ESPN, and so they called and said, look, we want you to come up to Bristol and talk about Javier Lopez signing with the Orioles. And so I had never been in studio before. I'd always done the one-shot things where you're sitting in front of a camera with an earpiece and you're looking directly into the camera, and that's what I was comfortable in. I had never been in a studio, and so I go up there and, you know, get made up and go in, and I'm standing on the side of the stage, and the stage manager says, wait right here. And then she puts me in a chair. And so they roll one camera in front of me. And I thought, okay, well, this is what I'm used to. One camera that I look into, and that's uncomplicated. I can do that. And then they go to commercial break, and all of a sudden there are four cameras rolling at me, and here comes Dan Patrick, who I had never met before, okay? I had talked to him, you know, my earpiece, that sort of thing, but I'd never met him in person, and he comes over, you know, smooth TV guy, probably could do TV out of the womb, and he's yes. like, hey, Buster, how's it going? Nice to meet you. And I see all these cameras rolling at me, and my heart rate's going up to about 200 beats a second. And Dan's talking to me. I'm not hearing him because all I'm trying to figure out is, where am I supposed to look? And so I asked Dan, and he goes, well, it's all very simple. You start out at me, and then you go to the jib, and then you go to camera three or whatever the sequence was. And then in the middle of that, I hear 5 seconds. And so they come back, and he turns. The Orioles have signed Javier Lopez. Can you tell us about it? And what happened after that was like the closest thing that I've ever come to the broadcast news thing, where you just have the flop sweat overtake the person. And it was awful, and it was a total disaster, and I walked off, and I'm like, okay, they'll never let me back on television again. And Chuck Solitaro, who's a news editor at ESPN, greeted me because he knew that I would be feeling very badly about what took place. He goes, don't worry about it, Buster. We got your free information. You'll figure out the TV stuff as you go along. And thank God that they, you know, ESPN has a lot of networks, because I got a lot of batting practice, so to speak, and a lot of opportunity to try different things, because I needed it. You know, I needed to make a lot of mistakes, and I still do.
Chuck's name has come up several times on this podcast lately. I'm a Wisconsin grad, and I grew up in Connecticut, so my dad and Chuck became friends like 15 years ago or so, and I saw Chuck this past weekend for a very regrettable Wisconsin-Penn State game.
Well, he was absolutely – I loved working with him, you know, a great standard. He and Vince Story, I felt like, you know, created such a great standard for ESPN, where, you know, folks like Peter Gammons obviously starting it, and now Adam Schefter and Woj and Jason Stark and Tim and people coming through And I thought it was, you know, an important part of the evolution of ESPN that they had old newspaper people with that sort of standard about information.
Speaking of newspapering, as you look back on your work at the Times and before that, what is, you think, the best game story you ever wrote?
Boy, I feel like that I did well on Game 7 of 2001 in the World Series. It was the last game that I did when I was covering the Yankees. I was coming off the beat at the end of that year, and Tyler Kepner was going to step in after that. When I was at the Baltimore Sun in 1996, the Jeffrey Mayer game, I'll never forget, you know, that all played out in right field in Yankee Stadium. And I went into the Orioles clubhouse after the game. And this is long before you got all the, you know, replay and 5,000 angles. And there were a crowd of Oriole players gathered around the one TV monitor in the visitors clubhouse at Yankee Stadium. And they're all looking to see what the video showed of that play. And so, you know, that was very interesting too, because Rich Garcia, who was the one who made the call on that play, went into the interview room after the game. Think about this. Went into the interview room after he'd seen the replay and said, "I blew it." And, you know, that sort of accountability was remarkable. And for the Orioles, there was little consolation in it because it was such a critical call. And, I mean, that was a real memorable game, and it was fun to write about.
Earlier, when you talked about making the transition from newspapering to ESPN, you discussed wanting a new challenge. So I don't want to ask you to breach journalistic integrity or anything like that, but it was interesting to me when Lee Jenkins, formerly of SI, took a job kind of unspecifically in the storytelling department with the Los Angeles Clippers. And I was wondering, like, for you, let's say an organization that you really respect was willing to reach out and create a role for you. This isn't like you trying to get it or trying to leverage ESPN into something, but it's somebody creating a position for you. Have you ever thought about whether you would want to shift from journalism to working for a team if that circumstance arose?
It has arisen a couple times where people raise the possibility just in conversation, "Hey, have you thought about doing this? You know, would you like to work in a front office?" And I immediately dismissed it and changed the subject because I have no training in that. And I had really great stratomatic teams when I was in college, but I think that, you know, what is it? The old Clint Eastwood line, a man's got to know his limitations. I love to write. And I love to tell stories. And when it was brought up, I also thought ethically it was not something that I should discuss if I'm making sense. You know, cause these are theoretically people that I'm covering, and I didn't feel comfortable even having the conversation.
No, I can understand that. I also wanted to shift real quick. Pace of game and youth viewership is always kind of an issue with baseball. I think the issues that baseball has are overblown, because if you look at the ratings on a regional basis, they're just insane, even in markets that don't necessarily have competitive teams. But with the World Series ratings down and attendance down, people are going to make it a story again. Let's say you're in charge of baseball and you can implement anything you want. What would you do or not do to change the pace of play?
Well, one thing is that I do think it's a concern. I did think that Rob Manfred, when he spoke during the World Series about how he feels like that there is too much discussion about all this in baseball, I think he was right to a degree, and I agree with you. I think that it can be overstated. You know, when people say, "Oh, baseball's, you know, dead," or "baseball's dying," and you're like, "Yeah, that's right, 70 million people bought tickets to games and they're watching." I wouldn't declare it dead yet. There are a lot of players making a lot of money, a lot of teams making a lot of money, so I think it's far from that. I do think that they, you know, have a concern about trying to sell it to a younger audience. I have two kids. I have a 14-year-old son who's absolutely sports crazy, and he said to me those words, that baseball's boring to him. Last winter when I spoke at my old high school, you know, there was a group, a room full of about 100 students there. And I said, and one of the students asked about the pace of play stuff. And I said, look, how many of you in this room would sit down and watch a baseball game for 3.5 to 4 hours? And looking at the faces of these kids, I felt like I might have asked them if they wanted to go to prison for 5 years. you know, just given the reaction. And I do think that they need to move it along. And I do think that the endless pitching changes, you know, that sort of thing, that's a concern, where the analytics, which you can't argue with the numbers, the analytics have taken the game to a place where, you know, we're seeing 6-7 pitchers used to get through a 9-inning game. And while it might make sense statistically in terms of the product, I think it's a problem. And I wrote about this early last season, that I do think they need that baseball needs the starting pitchers to have preeminence. They need them to be the Hulk Hogan, you know, the Andre the Giant of the sport. And they need them to be important. They need the matchups of a Kershaw versus a Bumgarner, you know, a Sale versus a Scherzer, that sort of thing. And so the rule I suggested, and I have no confidence it would ever be adopted, would be to limit teams, managers at the beginning of each game to 4 pitchers, with obvious exceptions of blowouts or injuries, 4 pitchers for a 9-inning game, which would, I think, take baseball back to a place where the starting pitcher would be important. I think it would help move the game along. I also think it would help from the union perspective. I think it would be important because they need the starting pitchers to be the driving forces in the free agent market, and that is increasingly becoming less and less of a thing because their roles are being diminished. And so I think that, you know, big picture, that to me is an important thing for them. They have to reduce the number of pitchers that are being used in each game, because I just don't see 14-year-old kids like my son being interested in watching a parade of relievers that they don't know coming into games.
I can definitely see that. I talked to Pat Crakes, who was a former Fox Sports research executive, and he said one thing that, like, their department found out when he was there was that maybe the youth isn't watching baseball as much, but they return to baseball when they form families. So I think Yes. That's some that I've actually, like, noticed that happening with myself as I've drifted back into baseball a lot more over the last couple years than I was for maybe the decade before it. But I definitely agree with you that they should do something to limit the amount of pitchers, maybe even just, like, limit the amount of mid-inning pitching changes a manager is allowed to make per game. Because you watch some of these games, like the Cubs will have 4 pitchers in an inning or something, and it's just crazy.
Yeah, and you know, during the summer, I had this great conversation with 2 really prominent pitchers, and I wish I could say their name, but, you know, the whole conversation, we were just sort of spitballing, and I mentioned my idea of, you know, limiting the number of pitchers, and one of them said, well, you know, the union would never go for that because, you know, you're essentially restricting jobs. However, we just talked about before about the huge volume of relievers in the market. That's going to diminish how much each of those guys are getting. I feel like that increasingly relievers are becoming to Major League Baseball the way running backs are to the NFL, very disposable products where they promote these guys. They basically tell them, we want you to throw the ball as hard as you possibly can for 1 inning. They throw 60 innings and then they break down like running backs in the NFL. And then they just call up the next guy. And it's not a good trend, and I think from the union perspective, and yes, I think these 2 pitchers are right to point out, would the union walk away from jobs if they felt like that by coming up with this rule that you and I are sort of talking around about limiting pitchers, use of pitchers in some way, that there would be a payoff for the union by, back to my original point, restoring the preeminence of the starting pitchers, which I think is really needed for the financial structure for the Players Association.
I know you're really busy this time of year, so I want to get you out of here on this. When I started the Big Lead, it was in November of 2014, and pretty soon after that, you did an interview with a writer here at the time, Mike Cardillo, where you talked about how every team's fan base accuses you of having bias about others. And I just want to say that I love that you still tweet out that piece once every month or two. It makes me very happy.
I appreciate that. Yeah, it was a great collection of tweets sent at me accusing me of bias against their particular teams. And I think 29 of the 30 teams are represented, or 28. but I absolutely love it because, I mean, every day, and you love the passion of fans saying, you know, you hate the Mariners, you hate the Padres, you hate the Yankees, and I get it all the time. And, in fact, on my podcast, when we do the weekly power rankings, right in the middle of that, you hear a voice screaming, bias! Well, that's my son, who accuses me of bias against his Atlanta Braves, and it's kind of a running joke between us. But I greatly appreciate that piece, and we'll continue to tweet it out when I see opportunities when people talk about bias.
Thank you, Buster. I really appreciate your time. Hope to talk to you again in the coming months. Once again, that's Buster Olney from ESPN. Thank you again for coming on the podcast.
Absolutely, Ryan. Great to talk to you.
Familiar touch turns strange.